I'm speaking today with Philip Andrews, who is running for Congress in District 7. Philip, first question I'd like to ask, why are you running for this office?
Well, other than the basics of making a difference and so on, you know, and the major issues that are hurting our country, I feel called to do it. I mean, I feel like everything I've experienced in my life, my knowledge, my skills, what I've been exposed to, has brought me to a point to run for a legislative office. I really believe that I can make good decisions for the nation as a whole, both for the domestic concerns we have and the international ones. So, I mean, you know, there's a lot to tackle. I've been at this campaign for a year now. I ran before for state representative. And, you know, through the grueling process of a campaign, you really start to be introspective and really look a little beyond all that's going on and why you're running. So, I mean, you know, I've been working on this campaign for a year. I've sacrificed a lot. And the campaign is like a marathon, and you've got to reach down deep and find the energy to go forward. So I'm running, I believe. I'm running because I believe. I genuinely believe it's worthwhile.
Your business is private military, which I think is...
Yes.
I think you're the first person I've interviewed on a campaign who can say that. Tell me about what it is you do.
Okay. So, my work is in the Philippines. There's places in the Philippines that's extremely hostile, corrupt. People are harmed there. Businesses are harmed in the work that they need to get done. This kind of situation is replicated all over the world in many different countries. And you have places where groups of individuals come out and harm others in a fierce way. So based on that, the U.S. Department of State has a sub-department called the Directorate of Defense Trade Controls. And under that, certain people like myself and the people I work with can get approved to build security teams that are equipped with military weapons. So really that's the difference versus any other security types of companies that exist. So we can have military weapons such as rifles and hand weapons and under extraordinary circumstances perhaps a naval vessel or something like this. I can acquire these things and put them to use. But how it works is every contract or engagement that people get into has to be approved by this Directorate of Defense Trade Controls. It's not a simple process where, you know, there are movies about what we do, and they make it look glamorous, and they make it look mercenary and stuff like this, and that has nothing to do with what we actually do. At the end of the day, we're defensive security. All of our people are people who have spent their life in the Philippine Army and are now retired, and they do this kind of contracting for jobs to make a living. And it's dangerous. And so, I mean, there's nothing glamorous about what we do. It's a tough, tough job.
When you say defensive security, what sorts of things are you defending or securing?
It would be common situations would be a construction site. When I think of the Philippines, a construction site of something big and important, places where they mine for resources, maybe gold and diamonds, oil exploration. You know, you have these situations where a big oil company might come in and want to drill. And, I mean, you've heard of the corruption in other countries. You hear of where they have to grease a lot of hands to get by. And sometimes if they don't do that, really bad things happen. You know, people get harmed. And those people who are doing the harming expect to get paid. And, you know, they can either deal with that sort of problem or they can pay for serious security to defend the legitimate business operations that they have going on.
And, you know, just how does U.S. policy of any sort, I guess I'm unfamiliar with your operations, so I'm sort of grasping here, but how does U.S. policy intersect with what you do, and is there something about U.S. policy that you would work to change, differ, modify, add, or subtract as a congressperson based on what you've learned from what you do?
Well, I think you make this question leads especially into the defense of our nation. And it's an area that's not very discussed very much at all in detail. You know, and I've tried to do that by sharing with the American people that, you know, we spend $1.5 trillion a year on military defense, war, rebuilding other nations. Now, recently, that's been cut down lately quite a bit. But for the last decade, under the Bush administration and stuff, they lost their minds and went to war and did all that stuff. But ultimately, where it leaves us today is we have 900 bases outside of our country. 900, which is insane when you think of the size of that and the cost of that, and that we are the only ones paying the bill. And there's two levels of this. We have the bases all across Europe since World War II that probably do not need to be there anymore. We probably do not need to defend Japan and Germany anymore. You know, but we have $1 trillion worth of military assets sitting in those countries. It's unnecessary. I think that those countries, from this point moving forward, can defend themselves. What I would really like to see, as they are our friends and allies, is to trade those assets to those countries for the forgiveness of debt. That's one level. So I would like to see not using in the future so many bases around the world. So we have the bases and the conditions of our First World Alliances where things are pretty safe and friendly. The other level is where we have bases in third world places all over the world. And you know, over time we established a base here and there to create peace. But on some level, there still is no peace in those places, you know, and all they are is an economic resource to that small country, but a drain on us. And at the end of the day, they are not eliminating the dictators and you know, the people who are hostile to human rights at all. Because, you know, when you build a base in the middle of nowhere, and you have all those soldiers spending money at local restaurants and bars, and then the base contracts with local companies, who do you think those people are? Those are the people that owns those restaurants tend to be the people we were there to stop or change for some particular purpose in the first place. And my argument would be that it's not effective. You know, and maybe it once was in the past, but at the end of the day, this military cost is the number one reason our debt is at $15 trillion. Or now it's at close to $16 trillion, I think. And the bigger issue that we don't talk about much in the Democratic Party is the decline of currency value. That's it. That's the number one thing. And what that ultimately translates to is a bad economy and a worsening economy. And the average American who is lucky to retire with $200,000 in their account 20 years from now, it's going to be worth nothing. You know, this is a big issue. And so we have to figure out how to reverse that. And for me, you know, I want to look at that cost first. And certainly if we could not have a yearly deficit, that would be a great place. But whatever money we save in this defense spending, I think can be placed in our domestic programs so that we can increase benefits to Medicare, Medicaid, now the Affordable Care Act, which I do support, education and Social Security and on, the big things, the things that matter. You know, because ultimately, when we look at what happened with the war, for example, Iraq, you know, and we look at our size of defense, we took the nation of Iraq in about 30 to 40 days with just a tenth of our military power. My attitude is then that maybe a tenth of our military power is all we need for the defense of our nation. You know, and I'm not advocating that we cut our current size down to a tenth, but it would seem reasonably to me that instead of 900 bases, that we cut it down to 100 or 200 bases outside this country would probably be fine.
Okay. What sorts of things would you like Congress to do, would you advocate to do as a member of Congress to help keep the economy, you know, on its path towards recovery from this terrible recession we were in?
Yes. Well, without repeating everything I just said, I would say everything I just said would make a significant difference in the economy if we can increase the currency.
Decreasing
value.
Military spending would be one
right,
thing.
Right. But if we did trade those assets and get debt forgiveness and get our currency value back up, that's one long-term thing. Trying to get our currency value above and beyond those in our first world competitors, you know, allowing us to buy more is a big deal. The other thing is, as a Democrat, I'm a big proponent of free trade. You know, now that doesn't mean that I don't believe in regulations. I do believe in regulations. I think regulations are a great thing. But I also understand the value of free trade. It's actually what's made us so prosperous. And that's been an interesting thing that gets attacked a lot because we talk about jobs going overseas and so on. But the first thing I'll start with then is I think it's an over-exaggerated idea that government can control our economy. Certainly, the few things that we have done since Obama, some of the bailouts, which were not very exciting, but tax benefits and lowering interest rates, et cetera, they play a small part. But, you know, the economy is sort of an organism of its own. It's got its own life. I think that the U.S. still has the advantage over everyone else. I certainly think that when we look at new energy processes, really what we can do is we can take a period of time to export more and try to sell and try to control that a little bit more than we have been. You know, we talk a lot about oil and production here and so on, but as a lot of people are not familiar, it just goes off to some major world market and then gets sold from there. If we can take some time to control our own oil reserves and make that production here, hopefully that would play a part. The other thing is our country has to get innovative in really unique ways. You know, one of the ideas I have that probably people consider a little far out, but I think was work, is one thing that American can export at this time is education. It's an interesting concept. Education. I say that because we have a lot of foreign students who want to come here to study. And so something I think would be innovative is to have academic programs both here and online offered by great American universities, particularly here in Texas, what I'd like to see, offer programs in the major languages of the world. Because you have a lot of extremely wealthy students and people out there that do not need to come to America for a life, but they want to come here and get a credential and then go back to their country and run their family's businesses and so on. And with every student that comes over here, it can be somewhere between $30,000 and $50,000 a year that they're going to spend here. So I would, you know, a university like UT, the University of Texas, has got some 11, 12 different campuses. It would be fantastic if we can transform one into offering most common majors like in business or engineering in the major languages such as Chinese and Spanish and so on, because what we could do is we could have a four-year plan that teaches English along the way, but teaches their major studies in their language. With the sole purpose of educating them and sending back, we can create a visa program that makes it clear that they won't be staying here afterwards, unless, of course, we're desperate for whatever skill set they're developing. You know, but this is an interesting idea. If you had, I forget the number off the top of my head, but if you were to develop a program where we could educate 100,000 students a year right here in Texas, now the number is quite high. And, you know, this idea that I'm stating, it's not original. It's done in Europe. You know, you have universities, I believe, in France and Germany that will teach their studies in a different language, such as France and Germany and so on. The big online universities have started accepting foreign students a long time ago, and it's a major part of their revenues. So there's things that we have in America. We have to accept that as a first world nation, we cannot manufacture toothbrushes here and then be sold for $10 each. You know, we got 150 million people in America that are poor or near poor, and I can't sell them a $10 toothbrush. It's a bad idea. But we have to come up with other resources that people want. I thought education would be one that works. And certainly we have to give incentives.
Shift the subject a little bit. Immigration reform has been something that has been considered to be a federal issue that hasn't, you know, for a while, and Congress hasn't yet taken it up in a meaningful way. What does comprehensive immigration reform mean to you? What does that look like to you?
Well, other than being supportive of the DREAM Act, it's time. It's certainly time to, at least at minimum, get people registered and get them visas. Get them visas to work and live here for a while, and maybe have a long-term plan to determine what they want to do after that. But if we've got 11 to 20 million illegals here at this time, if we can at least get them work visas, green cards, student visas, whatever's necessary for a period of 5 years, with something after that, I think that'd be great. Certainly we hear the stories of people who have been here for 20 years because they were brought here when they were 6 years old. They've lived in the whole system and they still find themselves illegal. I'm sort of compassionate to those people and would consider for them to become citizens right away. But it is, you know, I'm not much for this concept of building walls and all of that stuff. I think it's ridiculous. I think, if anything, it's a plan for Republicans to give their buddies a big construction contract, you know, and waste our money a whole lot more. You know, and I find that I think most people who are here illegal are just trying to get by like the rest of us. So there's no reason. I think it's terrible that there's such a judgmental attack on the Hispanics specifically that I've always seen in my lifetime. And I'm certainly against that sort of bigotry.
Recently, there's been a controversy over the way insurance companies cover birth control and the way employers are required or not to provide that kind of coverage for their employees through their health care plans. President Obama recently proposed a compromise on that to allow some exemptions for religious institutions. What's your opinion on the compromise that he came up with for that?
Well, I'm kind of disappointed in him for it. Because I don't care whether you're a religious institution or not. If you're going to accept federal money, then you need to accept the terms that there are. You know, and we are a pro-choice society. That's all there is to it. The woman's rights to make a judgment on that particular matter is up to her, and I support that.
Okay. Do you support or oppose the proposed Keystone XL pipeline be built through the United States?
I'm more supportive of it than other Democrats I've seen. You know, I think certainly I would have my environmental concerns and I want to see that protected. But for the most part, I see the pipeline as staying competitive. You know, just like those jobs can be brought overseas and the nothing that government can really do to stop it, so can oil companies. You know, they can move too. And we kind of got to think of a bigger picture here and how to maintain control of the energy industry. That's ultimately what I'm going to say to you.
Okay.
I'm going to say that I would support that pipeline because it's another part of us maintaining control okay. of the energy industry of the world.
What do you see as being the issues specific to the 7th District that you would want to work on or emphasize or you know try to deal with?
Well, I think the number one problem I see that's not just for the 7th District, but it's here because it's going to have to do with HISD, the school district, you know. But it's as Texas as a whole is education funding. Education funding is going to have to be a necessity, and the federal government's going to have to step in where Texas has failed. It's really clear that that Texas is run by Republicans at the state level, and they have cut education funding by something over $5 billion. Now that's what people are saying for 2012. And it's just, it's really unbelievable. And what needs to be said right here is, a lot of Democrats aren't talking about it, but when they cut education funding, their reasoning was, we don't have any money. So, but at the same time they cut the funding over $5 billion, they raised construction spending by $3.6 billion in 1 year, and to be paid for by debt. It's just completely bizarre. It's a lack of values completely. And the Democratic Party does need to get together with that particular message. Because it's like, you know, they're saying we don't have money, and but yet they're going to turn around and give their buddies a bunch of construction contracts that we pay for with bond debt. But you know, what happened to not having any money for anything else? And they always cut education. And here's just an example where Republicans don't value education. They think as long as you got a book and a pencil, you're fine. You know? And where we have to step in is that. My general belief is this probably April, across the state of Texas, we're going to see some 30 to 50,000 teachers lose their jobs for 2012. With that, we're going to see a lot of teachers just quit in general. Most of those teachers will be senior citizens that have been teaching for 30, 40 years of their life. And the reason that the school districts are going to get rid of them is because they're the highest paid at this point. So that is something that we got to look at and try to deal with. Another thing is the state legislature approved for school districts to cut salaries of teachers that will be working next year. And you know, that those salary cuts are going to be $5,000, $10,000 a year. Currently, I've been told by teachers who are in high school and elementary that they've got 40, 50 kids in their classroom currently here at HISD, and then it's getting worse in the suburbs. Parents are going to start getting nickel and dimed for every extracurricular activity that their kids want to participate in. So, I mean, that's it. That's probably one of the most major things that we can deal with locally that will be a crisis here in Texas moving forward.
What's your opinion of the district that was drawn through the redistricting process? Do you think is the current CD7 fair and representative? Or what changes,
you mean,
if any,
in the sense of multiculturally?
However you want to define that. Or what changes, if any, would you like to see made to it as the litigation continues?
Well, if they would write it up to be a Democrat district, I'd be very happy. But they didn't. They gerrymandered, you know, to be a Republican district. And I mean, for the most part, I think it's very multicultural. You know, I mean, it's less than half white now and half everything else. And I mean, on that level, it's fine, I guess. It's going to be a tough fight for this district. Certainly, you know, the Republicans drew as many districts as they could to be historically Republican. And this is going to be one that's going to be a real hard fight. With Culberson probably having a 7% advantage. It'll be interesting, though, if Culberson doesn't even win his primary, because he's got a primary opponent who's a Tea Party guy, and as you probably expect, we're going to have low voter turnout in May in this primary, and it'd be very interesting to see if he gets kicked out of there. And, I mean, ultimately, when dealing with this primary and having two other opponents, they're going to have to decide what type of personality is going to be more attractive to the greater district. You know, you've got a lot of independents and Republicans that are angry at the Republican Party. But if they are going to vote for a different candidate, a Democrat in general, they need to be one that's rational, at least from their perspective. Hopefully I provide that. I may hold a lot of liberal issues, but for the most part, I consider myself a moderate person. You know, and I'm not going to hide from that. I'm going to have integrity on that from the beginning. You know, and that's what I'm offering. Because one of the reasons I'm running is I'm tired of cowards. I'm tired of cowards, and it doesn't matter what party they are, whether Republican or Democrat, just getting up there and telling their primary voters what they want to hear, but then at the end of the day doing something completely different.
Okay. If you win the nomination and President Obama were to call you up and say, Philip, I'd like to come down and campaign for you in your district, what would you tell him you would like to hear him talk about in District 7?
Well, certainly education, I think, will be the big issue for us as Democrats in the sense of having a chance to win it. But first of all, I'm not going to run from them. I'll ask them to spend a week with me, you know, and I think that's another thing. I respect the office of president, and for particularly Obama, I love him. I have a great loyalty to him. And when I'm serving in Congress, I'll be there to make sure that we help him get his job done. And hopefully, if any number one issue would be to try to expand benefits under this Affordable Care Act.
Okay. As you mentioned, you do have two opponents in this primary. When people go to vote on May 29th, why should they vote to make you the nominee for District 7 and not one of your opponents?
Because I'm the better choice.
All right.
But, I mean, you know, those people are, I'm sure they're very good people. You know, they're probably running for the same reasons I am. And I think ultimately Democrats in District 7 have to look at the three candidates, see what they've tried before, see what's going to be different. You know, this district's been held by Republicans for 44 years. You know, and I think, I'll tell you, the one thing that makes me different is my life success is a product of the Democratic Party. My life success is a product of the Democratic Party, and I say that because, you know, like a lot of other candidates, I grew up in pretty terrible conditions. You know, there's nothing unique about that. But I did. I grew up in extreme poverty. My mom worked for Walmart. She could only make $900 a month or something like this. And as a single mother with two children in that circumstance, I, at 11 years old, had to start working. And the result of that would be is halfway through my sixth grade year, I would drop out. Leave school completely and not return until I decided to go to university at 17. When I decided that, you know, still being in poverty, all those teenage years, I collected cans for recycling, I delivered newspapers, I worked on construction sites. You know, but at 17, when I realized that my American dream had to begin with a university education, the saving grace for me was the Pell Grant. And so I point that out because the Democratic Party and progressive values, starting way back before you and I were born, had this idea that we were going to have mechanisms in place that helped people to get along, to help make life a little bit easier in achieving those goals. For me, it was the Pell Grant. You know, and I forget the number, but at that time it was $3,400 a year or something like this. It paid for three full-time semesters at the Houston Community College where I was able to start and then later transfer to the University of St. Thomas here in Houston where I got my bachelor degree through a combination of other grants and scholarships and paid for. I graduated with a bachelor degree with political science and philosophy studies. I would continue on to a master degree in accounting that I did complete at St. Thomas as well. And, you know, so for me, education was that gateway. Where government helped me, where the Democratic Party and all those people that led before I came around, they gave me that program. You know, now the Pell Grant's one thing. Certainly as a child, I sat in the welfare lines and got the food stamps and all that stuff. And that was a real struggle. It was. But it leaves me where I'm at today. I'm not a rich person or anywhere near that. But certainly I've obtained the American dream. And based on such a life, there's a compulsion that I deal with in wanting to serve the community again. And that's why I've stepped up to do this. You know, this personal story that I've briefly shared here on this part is on my website. You can go back and read a brief summary of those events. I thought it was important there to put it there for just for other people who need inspiration at this time. You know, because it's very well needed right now. It's very well needed that Americans need to understand that no matter what your difficulties are and your challenges, if you do sacrifice a little bit more and work hard and reach out to those resources that are given to you, you can sort of overcome those barriers. And I think that's what makes me different. So I would hope that the Democratic Party would like to say, look, here's a guy that his success has been based on what we've done in the past. What we believe in works. You know, it's funny, I was listening to an Obama speech from one of his past, and he says, Republicans believe you got to pull yourself up from your own bootstraps. And he says, well, what if you don't have any bootstraps? And in my condition as a child, I didn't have any bootstraps. I had the boots, but the straps were given to me from others. You know, and through that, I took what was given to me and worked really, really hard. And I'm still working hard today, you know. And certainly the last 25 years of my life or something has brought me to this place. And that's what I'm trying to tell you. My life's experiences, exposures, the things I've done has brought me to this place to have walked in so many different sets of shoes, to have seen so many different things that, you know, being a legislator is a tough position. It's a tough job, and I think you have to be able to look at all dimensions of an issue when you finally make a decision. Perhaps that's what disappoints so many of us, is we believe in a person because they have a certain ideology, and then they get into government and they make these compromised decisions, and we're all kind of disappointed in them for it. But the reality is that's how things are done you know, dealing with 310 million Americans and what their needs are and to the rest of the world is pretty complicated. And I've just been so fortunate to end up where I am in life and just be raised by great people and have great things happen to me. I mean, there behind you is a photo of a man that over my lifetime, I grew up fatherless, but then later in my life, I acquired a mentor who was a great man, and he became a father figure to me, and then he later adopted me through the courts, and his name's Father Dennis Andrews. I was adopted by a Catholic priest, and it was an extraordinary experience to spend so many years under him and the people around him, and be out there trying to make a difference in others' lives. And, you know, I considered that path for a long time in some sort of ordained ministry and spent a lot of years working with people and really just getting to know the human condition and what makes us work. I love people. I'm a people person. It's one of the reasons I've ended up in this situation. And as a person with an accounting degree, I'm not any longer in accounting because I'm not one to sit behind a desk very well and all of that. And, you know, I got to do it. I'm running for office because I got to do it.
All right. Philip Andrews, thank you very much for talking to me today.
All right.